everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today is episode 122. And while this is always called the Lumber Industry Update, this is definitely a news show. I got a lot of, well, news to report. A lot of things going on in the world. I've got some really, really good feedback from some previous episodes. And I've got some good emails that I need to clean up on, frankly, clean out the inbox a little bit and respond to some of you guys. So that being said, let's get into feedback here. I think it was one show ago, I was talking about beech branches that had dropped and talking about a variety of reasons for that. I got an email from Mark, and there is a botanical property called sudden branch drop. And I'll include the link to this, but there's a whole article about sudden branch drop and how that could possibly be equating to the listener wrote in and said, why do these beech trees drop their branches? There's actually a couple of court cases where mature branches have fallen and hurt people. And this sudden branch drop, I don't want to call it a phenomenon, biological thing, was brought up. So yeah, apparently there are some trees, certain species more prone to this, where a mature branch will actually separate, not right at the trunk, but, you know, several feet or meters out from the trunk. And that's called SBD, or southern branch drop. Who knew? We learned something new today. Got an interesting email from Tom in reference to the IBAMA strike as it relates to the CITES Appendix 2 levying of Ipe and Kumru. And he was particularly scared because he's going to be building a deck in Kumru. And he's like, whoa, what's going on? Do I need to be freaked out about this? Well, here's the thing. The long story is the CITES levying isn't really going to affect the price of the new species on the list right away. I would expect probably 6 months to a year before we start to see some of that. The bigger issues are the slowdown in the export that's already happening prior to the strike, but with the strike and now with fewer workers to do the job. But here's the thing, decking is a seasonal product. And even if none of this stuff was going on, right now, this is being recorded in late March, right now is probably some of the best time to be buying a tropical decking species. Decking season is fast upon us. People will start building decks. If they haven't started now, they'll be starting in the next couple of weeks. So the demand is going to suddenly skyrocket. When we get to Memorial Day, the demand is at its highest and the prices are going to be through the roof. Also, the supply is going to be starting to wane at that point. But specifically in tropical decking, we are at the mercy of the rainy season. You can't ship and export tropical decking all year round. There are some ways to get around that, but most people are having to buy an entire year's supply of a tropical decking product all at the same time, and generally having them being shipped and arriving around February and March for the entire year. So if you're buying in March and April, all of your suppliers are flush with inventory. They're also probably heavily extended in borrowing to buy all that inventory, and they're looking to move it as quickly as they can. So it benefits the buyer to start buying your tropical decking. As you get into the middle of summer, inventories have started to decline and the new stuff, it's not like you can just go and buy new stuff. You could be 6 months out before the new stuff that you actually bought from Brazil actually comes in. Moreover, when the rainy season clogs up the roads and prevents any shipping, you're not getting any more material at all, probably until next February, maybe January at the earliest. So as we move into summer and the demand for more and more decking material, more and more construction is underway, the inventory is already on decline and the prices are going to go up pretty dramatically. It's been that way as long as I've been in the industry. It happens every single year. Throw into the fact that there could be fewer and fewer shipments going out due to whether it's strike, export certifications, or the looming CITES, which is not, it's not happened yet. That's all going to just continue to drive the price of Kumru up. So, and eBay for that matter. So while I'm not going to go quite on a limb and say, here's where the price is going to be, and here's, you're going to see a 10% increase here and a 10% increase here. What I can tell you is right now in 2024, you know, March of 2024, early April of 2024, it's probably as cheap as Kumaru is going to get. It's only going to get more expensive from here. So, you know, if you are looking to build a deck out of a tropical decking species, now's the time to buy. And frankly, things are just going to get crazier in the coming weeks. So Tom, if you're asking for me to predict where the price is going to go, I'm not going to grant you the satisfaction there, but I'm going to tell you, get on that and start buying right now, because it's just going to get more expensive. Bob wrote into me, and sorry, looking off camera, here's my notes. He said, you advised a Florida man to plant a cypress tree. I planted a bald cypress about 6 years ago, and it's probably 30 feet or better now. We were actually talking about planting a tree that maybe could be harvested in 15 to 20 years. So here's a good example. 6 years, his cypress tree is 30 feet high now. So that's an affirmation of my recommendation. He says, our soil drains poorly. He's in Florida as well, by the way. Bob's also in Florida. Our soil drains poorly, which is why I planted the cypress. Last summer, I noticed the tree putting up small knees in the backyard. What do I do with it? I don't want to tear up my lawnmower. It's starting to put up others. This is incredibly common for cypress. The cypress knees, if you cut them off, it won't kill the tree. Botanists are still a little confused about exactly what cypress knees are doing, but unlike a burl, if you cut that off, you're going to kill the tree, or at least you're going to dramatically weaken the tree, kill its immune system, if you will. The roots are not quite in the cypress knees. So the way to deal with those and prevent from killing your lawnmower is to kind of dig around them and cut them below the soil surface and then fill the dirt back in. And that way your lawnmower is fine. You're not going to kill the tree. You might possibly weaken the tree, but if the tree's already healthy to begin with, you should be fine. It's just one of those things. Any gardener will tell you that you can cut those cypress knees back and you're going to be fine there. Many of you have emailed me and said about the hornbeam episode that you can't get hornbeam in your Lee Nielsen chisels anymore. And just goes to tell you the beauty of buying lifetime tools. I bought my Lee Nielsen chisels more than 10 years ago. They have hornbeam handles. I have not needed to buy chisels since then. So I haven't looked to see that apparently Nielsen switched over to hard maple, which makes sense. You find a lot of, chisel manufacturers, tool handle manufacturers using maple. I don't know exactly when Lee Nielsen shifted over. It was decided that the sourcing of hornbeam was a little too difficult, which, you know, I brought that up in the last episode. So yeah, those of you who are thinking, ooh, I'm going to get some Lee Nielsen chisels with hornbeam on them. Sorry, you can't do that. The good news is socket chisels, it's relatively easy to make and replace your handles. So if you can get into some hornbeam through some source, you can make your own handles. And that's what I've done. I've actually made 3 hornbeam handles for other chisels and vintage socket chisels as well. And they match nicely with my Lee Nielsen ones. So sorry if you thought you were going to go out and buy some Lee Nielsen chisels with hornbeam on them. Just not going to happen. All right, so let's move on to the real meat of this, the industry news here. There has been a lot of stuff going on that, good news, bad news, exciting stuff. But first thing is something known as a TC kiln. Let me switch over here. TC is it Swedish? It's Swedish for cross circulation, but this is a new, air quotes, new kind of dry kiln where it's a really, really long kiln. The wood is loaded in on one side on railroad tracks, and it moves laterally along the entire kiln. So imagine the kiln is like, you know, a football field long. You're sliding the lumber in and it's going to roll on rail tracks along the length of that kiln. And as it's doing that, it's passing through different drying zones, zones that have different levels of moisture, different heat. And you can control the rate that it moves through there, you know, just by speeding up or slowing down the movement along the rail tracks. So you're moving into hotter areas, drier areas, wetter areas, etc. And there can be blast doors in between each area, but then you also can push air along the long axis of the kiln, constantly providing ventilation on those woods. What this means is you're not heating up and cooling down the kiln, you're maintaining a constant temperature in each one of these zones, and you're moving the lumber through it. It's incredibly more efficient and not having to essentially spend all that time heating up slowly and cooling down slowly, not to mention the energy expenditure that takes to heat up, you know, a kiln. If you can have these rooms at a constant moisture and temperature and just move the lumber to another room with a constant moisture and temperature, that's incredibly efficient. Now, obviously, the footprint of these kilns is enormous, but you can continuously move lumber through them, constantly loading in one side, rolling on the railroad tracks and coming out the other side and, you know, moving circularly, putting another bit on the input and rolling out the other side. That's why it's called a continuous kiln. So the drying tech is still a dehumidification kiln, but ultimately it is something that it's so much more efficient. And because of the fact that you're running the wood through it, you can push a lot more through and you can actually run it not only continuously, you know, motion, but run it around the clock. It's just a matter of having somebody, you know, catching on one end and pushing in on the other end. It's pretty cool use of an old technology. Certainly you got to have a larger yard to be able to deal with all that, but I thought it was pretty dang cool. Let's look at something a little bit more sobering, I guess, is one way to put it. If you don't know, I'm based in Baltimore. My lumber yard is in Baltimore. And, well, we had kind of an issue this past week. A container ship ran into the key bridge that spans the Baltimore Harbor, and the bridge collapsed. Absolutely horrible disaster. Several people have died. The port is still completely closed down. It's been very upsetting. Me personally, I actually commuted over this bridge twice a day for about 15 years. So I'm incredibly familiar with the bridge. It was a beautiful bridge. It was a beautiful drive out around the harbor past the old Bethlehem Steel area. And it's really surreal that it is gone. Personally, I was surprised how much I was affected by looking east and not seeing that bridge spanning over there. From a lumber perspective, though, in January of 2024, 62,400 tons of lumber went through the Port of Baltimore. It's not the largest port for lumber, but it's up there. And the Port of Baltimore actually is an auto hub more than anything else. I think it's the largest hub of import and export of automobiles on the entire East Coast. So with the port being closed right now, while nothing can go in and out of the harbor, automobiles are certainly affected. For us personally, you know, we located our yard. We moved from Philadelphia to the Baltimore area in the 1960s because of the port. Because of, you know, a lot of things going on at the Port of Philadelphia, the Baltimore port was more attractive to us. And we've been in the 1960s, been there since the 1960s because of that reason. Certainly, we've shipped into Philadelphia. We've shipped into Norfolk. And neither one of those was quite as attractive to us. So just us personally having to shift to other ports, it's certainly difficult. Some of the lumber that we had that was already en route, it's kind of like, where's it gonna go? And in many instances, the shipping line itself is making the call on whether to go to Norfolk or whether to go to Philadelphia. This is just a small microcosm of everything that's going on. Certainly, there have cranes on site. They're cleaning up the channel right now. And ideally, within a couple of weeks, container ships will continue to be able to reach the Port of Baltimore and business will return, I don't want to say as usual, but certainly the transit being able to go across the bridge instead of through the tunnels where hazmat is not provided, but there's also some height limitations and things like that. That's going to continue to be a problem for years to come. I don't know what the current projections are for rebuilding the bridge, but from a lumber perspective, it certainly has been a major impact when you talk about, you know, almost 65,000 tons per month of lumber that's currently not moving through the Port of Baltimore. That's That's rough. That's particularly rough. Let's look at some more cutting edge stuff at this point. There is a grant that was just, well, granted on more research into CLT. I've been talking about CLT a lot, and I'll continue to talk about it. I still think that it's one of the most exciting areas of the lumber industry. But now we're talking about using thermally modified cross-laminated timber and carbon fiber together. And this is kind of a Venn diagram of several topics. I've talked about carbon fiber in the aviation industry, talked about carbon fiber as a tone wood in the past, and I've talked a lot about cross-laminated timber and certainly thermally modified timber. Taking all of those techs and pulling them together, taking not only a laminated, thermally modified product that's perfectly stable, but is super, super strong and rigid once you laminate it together, and then adding something super lightweight and rigid like carbon fiber could be particularly interesting. So the Army Corps of Engineers is working with this grant, and Washington State, I believe. Be really interesting to see where that goes. CLT is already very, very exciting, but if we can use some of the more cutting edge tech in the lumber industry, but also in material sciences like carbon fiber, it'd be really interesting to see what comes of this whole thing. Speaking of CLT, the Olympics are coming. And what's happening in any Olympics? Well, they always build stuff. Usually there's some sort of new building for it. Well, the Paris Aquatic Center is made out of CLT, mass timber construction. And more importantly, it's freaking cool looking. They have, let me get to, well, there's the inside, you know, all CLT construction, that kind of parabolic roof structure is designed to have a lower ceiling so that it's just less a column of air inside the building, so less energy required to heat it. And because of the way the seats climb up, you can still have a sight line. Even though the roof kind of sags down in the middle, you're looking down at the pool and your sight line is uninterrupted by the roof. Having a traditional flat roof would add a lot more air column to heat in there. And this just dramatically reduces that. Plus, it just looks really, really cool. Yeah, some of these images would just blow me away. The outside, well, yeah, they did recycled material on all the seats. There's some more melted plastic material for the seats. Let me get to this lamination. So you can see the the cross lamination that's happening throughout the structure here. Very, very cool. Let me go over one more. And there's an overall view of the structure, all CLT, all mass timber construction, and all incredibly sustainable, environmentally concerned, and all that fun stuff, which I think is just fascinating. That type of construction is going to be, you know, on the center stage for the Paris Olympics. Yeah, if I wasn't excited about mass timber construction before, definitely excited now. And while we're talking about Notre Dame, if you haven't already seen this, the state of France, the government of France, has this Restoration of Notre Dame website. They have now finished all the carpentry in the restoration. There's a lot of great videos on this YouTube channel that I will actually link to, but really some amazing stuff to look at, not only from a craftsmanship perspective, and I don't want to say the restoration of older trades, because in many instances, this level of timber frame construction, the best way to do it is the way they did it a couple hundred years ago. And there are several points made in this. My French is not the best, but I followed along the best I could, because, sorry, this whole thing is in French here.
Faire, savoir quelle technique est-ce qu'on allait employer. On a choisi de travailler à la main sur du bois vert.
Pour refaire
vraiment comme au 13e pour avoir les mêmes.
So I'll turn that off so that we don't have the French guy yabbering in my ear. There's a lot of different videos on this website, and those of you who have written in the past expressing interest in what's going on with Notre Dame, this is definitely the place to go to check it out. Everything from the stained glass guys to the lead removal and remediation to the plaster work, but more importantly, the biggest milestone has been the capping of La Forêt, which is the forest. Let me get this KeyBridge image out of here. This image right here, if you're not familiar in timber framing structures, once the structure is completed, the idea of attaching a bough of a tree on top for good luck. And that's what's going on in this image over here. As you can see, they've got this little sprig of green there, and all the carpenters are standing around because they've essentially finished the framing. All of those oaks that they harvested, all of the talk about finding the right white oak for this, it's all come to fruition. The forest is done, the spire is done, and the carpentry and the trades that went to bring this together has just been so cool. So if you haven't yet, go check out that YouTube channel. I will point to it in the show notes. Let me grab my notes real quick and see if I can at least show you what that was. Goodness gracious. Oh, I can't find it now. I will point to it in the show notes, but if you were to Google restoration of Notre Dame, you will find this all over the place. This whole website, of course, is in French. You can use Google Translate for it, but very, very cool stuff. So exciting to see that work has come to fruition and might actually be ready to go for the Paris Olympics, which, man, that would be very exciting, I think. Let's move on. Where are we here? We want to get into some viewer questions here. Again, I want to say thank you to everybody who's sending in these really great questions. Also, thanks especially to those of you who sponsor the show on Patreon. I've gotten some great questions from you there. Interesting point, as I was addressing envelopes to mail out last month's stickers for Hornbeam, it is amazing the number of people who are Patreon supporters who have tree-named streets. Lots of Maple Avenues and Chestnut Avenues and Oak Lane and Oak Trail Lane and Chestnut Trail Lane and cool stuff like this. And it got me thinking, and I remember reading this somewhere. One is like, I think it was an American Canopy, the book American Canopy. But during the early days of Philadelphia, William Penn, as he was laying out certain streets, he didn't use street signs. He just planted a tree. So on Chestnut Street, he planted, you know, where the street signs would be, he planted a chestnut tree. In some instances, he lined the streets with a chestnut tree or a maple tree or an oak tree. And that's how it became Oak Lane or Maple Lane or Chestnut Avenue. How much that applies in other cities, I don't know. But I do find it particularly interesting that we're talking a large percentage, probably 75% of my current Patreon supporters have some sort of tree name in their street. Very fascinating. I don't know if that's a prerequisite. I don't think it's a prerequisite to being a Patreon supporter, but I think it's interesting how people who are interested in a Lumber Update podcast just happen to live on a street with a tree named. So yeah, interesting stuff. We're supposed to be on viewer questions here. My tech is letting me down. So let's talk about some of these emails. Nick had written in and said that he had picked up some redwood logs, about two foot long by 12 to 18 inch diameter redwood logs. He lives in Florida, but he picked these up when he was out in California. He in-sealed them before he put them in his truck bed and drove them back to Florida. Very, very good move, because you know, all that air blowing across the truck bed could certainly dry those logs out and cause them to crack a bit. He says that they survived the trip nicely without cracking up too much, but now he wants to saw some of them into ingrain cookies to make a table, and the rest he will saw into boards. So he's wanting to know what he can do to preserve them. So in sealer, which he already did, he used a latex paint for the road trip. There are latex paint is a good option. The other thing you can do, and specifically for ingrain cookies are very unstable because you've got the entire cross section of the log, but then you've also got a relatively thin section that can crack and break apart. So the first thing I would tell you is saw it thicker than you're going to need by at least half. If you plan on making the table 2 inches thick, saw it 3 inches thick and let it dry in a thicker state. And then as you mill it to final dimension, do it slowly and be prepared for acclimation. The good news is it's all ingrained. The whole face is ingrained and you've got another ingrained face. So it will dump moisture and it will dry relatively evenly, but you have to make sure that it does it slowly. And with so much ingrain exposed, it will dry very, very, very quickly. So one thing that you can look at we're still in the aquatic center here. There is a product called Pentacryl, which I think is an outstanding product because it's not just an ingrain sealer, but it's also a bit of a stabilizer. This company, Preservation Solutions, that makes Pentacryl, they also make an ingrain sealer, which is a wax emulsion like you'd find with Anchor Seal, which is just a brand name version of that. Pentacryl goes a little bit further in that acrylic that's in it will seep into the fibers and stabilize it a lot more. A lot of wood turners use this to stabilize, you know, either punky woods or particularly movement prone woods. Pentacryl is one that will be fantastic for your ingrain cookies. The other thing you can do once you've painted Pentacryl on the surface is cut out a cardboard disc to match your cookie and just tape it to the outside. That cardboard will absorb some of that moisture away and keep it away from the wood. But the Pentacryl should really do the majority of that. The other thing is it's going to, adding that acrylic hardens the cell walls a little bit. The one thing you might want to consider doing, however, since you came, you know, this is California redwood and you moved it to Florida, which is obviously moist, very, very humid. You might consider spraying those cookies with a bit of Lysol first before you add the Pentacryl, just to prohibit the growth of mold. Because certainly with so much moisture in the Florida air, that is a potential issue. But Pentacryl to me is that kind of nuclear option. If you don't want to pony up the dough, I mean, this is what, a gallon listed here, that's $72. I honestly don't know what its coverages are. I'm sure that it probably tells you in the SDS on this website. The other thing you can do is just wax. If you've ever bought a turning blank and that turning blank came just coated in wax, that's what it's about. It's just good old-fashioned paraffin wax. Because you're making an ingrain cookie, you could melt a bunch of paraffin wax into a Rubbermaid tub or something and just dip the whole cookie in there. Coating it entirely in wax will dramatically slow down that moisture exchange and allow it to dry slowly. That's something that I've done on many turning bowl blank or pepper mill blank or something like that. And many of the ones that I bought them from a turning house, they've already come in wax. So that's the, I would say, cheaper solution, because paraffin wax certainly is not going to cost you much. Once you've bought like a tub to put it in and a way to melt it all, you know, there's going to be a little bit more expense, but I have to imagine that it's probably going to end up being cheaper than, you know, $70 to $150 for a Pentacryl to cover all the cookies that you're looking for. As far as the board you're looking to saw, I would just stick with an ingrain sealer. You can go to that same company where Pentacryl is available and buy an ingrain sealer. You can buy Anchor Seal, which is another brand of sealer, or you can make your own, you know, wax emulsion, basically creating a solution of wax and water. Or wax, and actually look up any of those things. You'll find out what you can mix them with. For me, just melting good old-fashioned paraffin wax and painting it on the end is probably the cheapest way to deal with that whole thing. I got an email from John who, let's read John's email. He said, I'm a hobby woodworker and until recently was a hardwood lumber inspector for a fairly large mill in New York. I really enjoyed learning how to grade lumber and working with it every day, but had to leave because I just wasn't making enough money. That's typical. And I was working the night shift, so I had no life. I have no life, but I work a day shift. What's my excuse? I've heard you mention before that there is a large labor shortage in the industry. So I was hoping you might be able to talk about what specific jobs are out there in the lumber industry for young guys like me trying to scratch that lumber itch, and what steps/training we would need to take to be qualified for these positions. Thanks for your great content. Well, thank you, John, for that question. And I wanted to bring this up because a couple of people have asked this in the past, and I think there's not a lot of mystery to this. Certainly, there will be more specialized positions within lumber yards, like lumber graders. One can take an NHLA grading course. and get certified by NHLA. That would be the education that you need. I honestly don't know how much that costs. We send people to it all the time, but it's kind of one of those things that gets mixed in with the internal costing of things. And I'm not really sure what that was. If my yard foreman were here, I'm sure he could probably tell me because he's the guy that schedules all that stuff. But you can go to NHLA, look them up online and find out when their next classes will be and sign up for it and certainly find out what that would cost. Being an NHLA certified grader would go a very long way to helping you get a job as a lumber grader. And a lot of the mills that I talk to, sawmills and such, they're looking for graders. But then there's also people who just buy lumber already graded. They don't do any of the drying themselves and they don't really need a grader. So kiln operators is another one. But again, if they're not drying their own lumber, they don't need a kiln operator. But many of these companies need people who understand lumber and understand how it's measured, understand how to deal with a customer and helping them through their cut list. All the things that I've talked about why does lumber cost what it costs? You would be surprised how many people don't quite understand and get kind of the simple mathematics of here's a pack of lumber and here are my project needs and how to go from pack of lumber to project needs and being able to consult with somebody and help them through their takeoff list or even do their takeoff list is a really valuable skill. The other more kind of tangible things are being able to run a molder, being able to run a ripsaw, being able to run a planer, being able to maintain those machines, incredibly valuable. A lot of the lumber industry is labor-based though, and many of these lumber companies are willing to train you. They're just looking for people who are willing to work and work hard. Let's face it, the lumber industry is not an air-conditioned industry. It happens outside in the rain, in the heat, in the snow. You get splinters. You get dirty. If you enjoy working with lumber, then it's you don't even think about it. But like if your laboring experience is working in an air-conditioned warehouse, then the lumber industry can be particularly difficult. Being able to operate a forklift is one thing, but being able to operate a forklift on a lumber yard, I call it off-road forklifting. It's a totally different skill set. But ultimately, most of these places, they will train you how to do this, and they just need people who work hard. If you're a hard worker and you have an interest in lumber, I would urge you to go to any lumber yard and apply. I guarantee you they will take you. And if you have interest, the sky's the limit. You could move into sales. You could move into purchasing. You can move into marketing, for God's sake. There's so many different directions you can head. All of our current molder operators used to be guys, you know, catching on the back end of a molder. And they learned day in and day out how a molder should be operated from the molder operator himself. The apprentice journeyman system is still very much alive in the lumber industry. So, you know, the easy answer to this is if you're interested, go apply. They will find a place for you. And if they can't, give me a call because I'm certainly hiring at this point. Let's see. Moving on here. Jesse had sent me a contact through the contact form on the website. That's lumberupdate.com. And Jesse says, we've been making, the company he works for, been making custom hardwood doors for 14 years. And I've been in the door industry for 24 years. We have a job coming up that will use anti-gray solid material. Can you confirm this is a cousin to the mahogany species? We are very familiar working with that material. Also, typical Type Bond 2 can be used to glue this, correct? It doesn't need to be wiped down and glued with epoxy like teak does, right? Thanks for your help. And thanks for the great podcast. I included that last part because it makes me laugh. This idea that teak needs to be wiped down with acetone and used strange exotic glues to glue together, I question that. It certainly won't hurt to wipe down the natural oils, but regular old Type Bond 2 or Type Bond 3 can be used. Once you've wiped away those oils, the PVA doesn't have any problem binding to it if it's just regular work. Now, if you're doing a bent lamination, yes, you might want to use an epoxy or at least a PVA glue there. But I think so many people are afraid of teak, and it's, yes, it's an oily wood, but there's a lot of other oilier woods out there. It's one of those things where if you're in a commercial sector and you're building a product for somebody else, it's best to stack the cards in your favor. And I think that's why these myths, I hate to even call them myths because there's some truth to it, but why these practices continue to be perpetuated, because nobody wants to be the guy who has a door delaminate on them, and somebody says, well, did you use epoxy? And you say, no, I use PVA. Immediately they point to that. In general, when we've had delam issues like that, we find that it's less about the glue and more about the thickness of the lams, or more about the quality of the wood in the first place. But that's not Jesse's question. His question is more about Anagray. So let's go to everyone's favorite wood database and look up Anagray. Anagray, for the most part, most people think of Anagray as a veneer wood. And it's interesting, and I'm assuming Jesse knows this because he said solid Anagray material. It's rare. Most of the Anagray that's out there has been peeled or sliced for veneer purposes. The thing about Anagray is it's incredibly homogeneous. It's a diffuse porous wood with practically no grain visible. And it's one of the reasons that makes a great veneer, because it lays down really smoothly on a substrate, but it also creates a really nice smooth substrate that can have all kinds of things done to it. You can French polish the stuff. It's so homogeneously smooth. But it is not a cousin to mahogany. Now, that in and of itself is a loaded statement. When you say mahogany, what do you mean by mahogany? That could be any number of species. When you say cousin, what does that mean? You know, Utile is a cousin to Sapele because it's in the same genus. African mahogany, some say, is a cousin to genuine mahogany, but it's not in the same genus. It's in the same family, the Meliaceae family, but so are thousands of other species. Once you move up the chain, taxonomically speaking, to family, there's a lot of stuff that's in there. You know, Pinaceae is a family. Think of how many, quote, pine trees roll up under Pinaceae, let alone how many pine trees roll up under the Pinus genus. So Sweetina, being the genus of genuine mahogany, Sweetina macrophylla, is not at all related to Anagray. Anagray is in the Pteria genus, which family-wise, oh, I don't remember. I looked it up. It's not Meliaceae. So it's not related at the species, genus, or family level. When you go above that, yes, it's probably related, but that's certainly doesn't make it a cousin, maybe a fourth cousin twice removed. But I could see maybe what you're getting at here. One of the things that makes genuine mahogany so wonderful to work with is it's so smooth grained. It's so closely grained, so homogeneous as you cut it. And that's one of the reasons it carves so well. Anagray will be similar in that respect. From a hardness perspective, it is very much similar to genuine mahogany. Some of the other structural numbers are a little bit different, but from a door perspective, I don't think any of that's really going to come to play that much. Honestly, I think you will be incredibly pleased working with Anagray just because of how homogeneous it is. Now, if your mahogany experience is genuine mahogany, South American, Sweetina macrophylla, you will not like Anagray as much because it is, you know, it is an African wood. It is going to have much more of an interlocked grain pattern than the South American mahogany. If you have a lot of experience working with Sapele or Kaya, African mahogany, or Utile, you'll like Anagray a lot more than those because it's easier to work with. It's more homogeneous than those, but it does still have some of that interlocked nature. So no, it's not a cousin, but I guess we could call it close-ish, right? Close enough. And then I think that brings me to the end of the show. That's all of your questions, all of the news. Frankly, I love this format of show, and we'll try to do this, from time to time, because there's so many news stories that pop up, on my radar. There's so many news stories that you guys send to me that, sometimes get, delayed, and I don't want to delay too long because then they're not really particularly relevant. So yeah, keep sending me those news stories, keep sending me feedback. I love to continue to talk about the feedback that I get, where we learn a little bit more, or we can fill in the blanks from a previous conversation on a previous episode. I love that stuff. And of course, keep sending in those questions. As always, lumberupdate@gmail.com is how you can reach me. You can go to lumberupdate.com. There's a contact form where you can submit your questions there as well. Keep sending those questions. Love to hear them. And go buy some lumber.